This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Political journalist Gary Wills has written best-selling critical studies of three American presidents, Nixon Agonistis, the Kennedy imprisonment, and Reagan's America. He's written for National Review, Esquire, and Time. His new book, Under God, is a collection of essays on the collision of religion and politics in the United States. Will was a Jesuit seminarian, but left before being ordained. Although the Constitution provides for a separation between church and state, Will says religion has always influenced political thinking in America.
Most Americans are very religious in profession and practice, a heavy majority, over 90% profess belief in God. And most Americans have a moral formation of their views in which ethics are not easily separable from religion. So if you want morality in politics, as most people do, you're bound to have religion in politics. Religious views on the role of the state, of the role of the economy, the role of war, race relations, all of those things have been tempered by people's religious upbringing. Defenders of slavery and opponents of slavery were religious in their fights during the abolitionist period. Look at the civil rights movement of the 1960s. That was entirely a church-initiated and oriented movement, at least in its early days. It came right out of the Black Baptist churches with preachers as the leaders, church people as the original troops, and that is one of the most inspiring episodes of our history. So sure, I think religion always has had a place in our politics.
Let me ask you about a couple of recent religious statements pertaining to the Gulf. Now, the National Council of Churches unanimously approved a resolution calling for the immediate withdrawal of most U.S. forces from the Gulf. And the American Roman Catholic bishops called on the administration to exercise restraint, and the bishops said that a war in the Gulf wouldn't fall under the just war standard. What effect do you think that these resolutions are going to have on George Bush?
I think they're going to have quite an effect because Bush has been unable to form his own moral argument for the war. You know, it's not as if we were fighting communism. Back in the days when that was the case, many churches went along because they felt that communism was an atheistic system that was a worldwide threat. Harry Truman always used to call it godless communism. And the churches had formed a long-standing opposition to communism. Now that that's gone, the churches seem to be free to voice the kind of opposition that arose in some of them during the Vietnam War. Of course, we've always had a conscientious objection tradition in Quakers and others, but because of our chaplain system, there has been a tendency of war to co-opt religion in American history. I think that's not going to be so easily done anymore. And George Bush, when he can't inveigh against communism, finds that he has to just attack as a monster Saddam Hussein, and that doesn't really give him a moral basis for arousing people. And Americans are very slow to go to war unless they have some crusading or missionary aspect to it. Our tendency not to be isolationist so much as to be insular has made us come somewhat reluctantly into worldwide engagements unless we can feel that we're defending, quote, the free world or spreading democracy or doing any of those other high-minded things. To talk about a war for oil or for resources or for jobs makes us sound too much like the Marxist caricature of capitalist imperialists looking for control of the world resources. So, absent his ability to occupy this moral ground, I think that the consensus that's forming between peace churches who had already spoken out and the National Council and the Catholic bishops, that's an extraordinarily broad spectrum of the religious community that's speaking out.
Bush portrays himself as a religious man. Do you think that resolutions like this from the National Council of Churches and the American Roman Catholic bishops are likely to have an impact on him because he professes to religion?
No, because the religion that he is drawn to more now is that of the evangelicals, and he'll find support among them. No, I think it's more a question of the political marketplace, that he will find that much of the territory that most presidents have found they had to occupy if they wanted to arouse the people, is being preempted now by this kind of response so early in the game. After all, the churches finally spoke out on Vietnam only late in the process, and I think they learned that they really should tell people to start considering the moral consequences of what they do early on. You know, the whole of the nuclear capability has troubled the churches for a long time, because that runs so far ahead of anything like the old just war and proportionality and other moral considerations that people are supposed to weigh when they go into war. So now, religious leaders do feel a certain wariness about getting launched on any war which might take them into a nuclear confrontation off at the end.
Do you think that war would be justified in the Gulf?
I don't know. I don't think that we have a sufficient reason. The closest that Bush has come to having a moral reason is that Saddam Hussein is morally despicable and might have access to arms down the line. The trouble with trying to get rid of a monster is who knows what will replace him. You know, the Kennedy brothers tried to assassinate Fidel Castro for years, and they never gave any thought, as far as the records show, to what would replace him. This focusing in on a villain and thinking everything comes from this one person is a kind of diabolical reading of history, that all you have to do is remove one person and the whole of a nation will be cleansed and changed, and its structure will change and its culture will change. That's simply not the case.
What do you think Bush's real motives are?
Oh, I think they're a combination. I think that he does feel that in the absence of the Cold War, which was a stabilizing force, oddly enough, the so-called New World Order is one in which America has to assert itself early on and try to play a role as a constructive leader. And sending over so many troops so fast was a way of saying, we're not out of the game, we're still a player. Unfortunately, Colin Powell said, we're sending so many troops so fast that the politicians can't dither, which is a quite unconstitutional way of thinking about the way we commit our national resources abroad. But there are a number of things. You know, there's the whole fear of the Vietnam syndrome, so-called. A number of people in the administration seem to think that the only thing wrong with Vietnam was gradual escalation, and that if we have this kind of quantum leap into the situation at the outset, we can treat a big struggle the way we treated Grenada or Panama. And I think they're going to find that that's not the case at all, that the Gulf is not a big Grenada, and just by sending preponderant force, we're not going to be able to have a quick, happy war of the sort that we thought we were growing used to after Vietnam.
You've written books on several American presidents. Are you thinking of one about George Bush? I imagine you're watching him very closely. And I wonder how George Bush, the president, is surprising you, if at all, as compared to George Bush, the candidate, and George Bush, the vice president.
Well, he's surprised me in the skills that he's used. He has been very skillful. For instance, the whole of the canvassing of the world and the marshaling of world opinion in this Gulf encounter, that was really quite deftly done. And, of course, his personal diplomacy with world leaders is something that is not surprising, but nonetheless is a skill that he's developed beyond most recent presidents. It goes very much against the pattern that Ronald Reagan followed, which was to act swiftly and unilaterally so that we didn't even tell Britain what we were going to do in Grenada, though that was part of the British Commonwealth. Mrs. Thatcher was upset. In that way, he's been quite skillful. His tin ear in domestic policy is, I don't know whether I'd call it surprising, but it's certainly of a large scale. His reliance on John Sununu. I suppose if we look back, he did allow himself to be guided in domestic affairs by an Ailes or an Atwater or a Baker, so much so that one of the most indicative things about his whole career is the way James Baker took him out of the race against Ronald Reagan. without even asking his permission, that he would allow that to happen in 1980 was a very significant thing about him, that he obviously will let people he trusts act in his stead, even when they do things that are not entirely what he would have done himself.
You've written that you used to believe that one should work for change within the system, but then you lost all faith in electoral politics.
Well, that's probably stating it too strongly. What I meant to say is that we place too much emphasis on electoral politics as if that were our only politics. And much of the most important political activity in America takes place outside electoral politics. In fact, most of our resisted changes of any magnitude, abolition, the civil rights movement, feminism, all came in through volunteer and protest, usually, activity by people who are not office holders. And when you look at it that way, our politics is really a much more interesting and vibrant and rich thing than simply who is elected to this office in a state or local or federal capacity.
Several of the essays in your new book are about censorship and moral censure. Let me first ask you to explain where you draw the line between the two.
Well, Nat Hentoff is very good at saying that censorship is something we accuse people of if they disapprove of something or want to prevent its publication or that kind of thing, but that's a misuse. Only the government or some official body, some legal body that has coercion of a police sort behind it can censor. If I say I don't like something and I don't think children should see it, that's not censorship. That's censure. That's my saying I think it's bad, and I have First Amendment rights of free speech to say that. And if I can persuade people to go along with me, then we will reach a consensus of the community that we won't show that, hear that, or whatever. So that, for instance, it's not against the law to call people niggers or kikes or whatever, but social censure inhibits people normally from using such vile terms. And that's a healthy thing. We want that, I believe. We want a community to express its moral preferences and to ask for standards which are not imposed by law, but reached by way of moral suasion among people who are giving the matter serious consideration. So I am entirely in favor of censure and opposed to censorship.
Do you think there should be constraints on federally funded art?
I don't think there should be constraints that say, as the proposal by Jesse Helms did, that this or that act cannot be shown. That makes no sense, because art can show any kind of act, and has. You know, it shows rape, it shows torture and mutilation of children. Dickens is full of the abuse of children. Shakespeare is full of the abuse of women. There's nothing wrong with showing particular acts in art. On the other hand, I don't think that it should be the business of political money to fund avant-garde art, because this is a public trust. This is something that the people, the taxpayers, are asked to support in the name of upholding the general culture. And there's something ridiculous in the idea that avant-garde people, ones who don't want to be part of the mainstream, who don't want to be part of the establishment, who want to attack the establishment or whatever, should say, but I can't do it unless the establishment supports me and approves me and gives me a stamp of approbation and pays for it. That seems to me to make no sense at all.
Well, on the other hand, though, it's always been my understanding that the National Endowment for the Arts was created not to support the mainstream, not to support the commercially viable, but to support the more marginal artists whose work isn't commercially viable. Their books aren't going to be bestsellers. Their performances aren't going to get huge audiences, but they're doing important work.
Well, but the trouble is, the politicians who are the ones who are responsible for passing this legislation are responsible to their tax-paying constituency, and they should be. Democratic accountability is an important principle in our government. And the idea that the politicians are going to be able to muster an approving constituency behind things that attack the culture seems to me absurd.
But the whole idea was that there would be a panel of experts about art who'd make these decisions. I mean, voters don't go to the booth and decide what's art or not, you know?
Yes, well, I'm not as entirely trusting of the experts in the realm of art as some are. I think that a great deal of log rolling and institution building goes on in those grants, and that there is no right to any of these things. By the way, these are a very recent addition to our national life. We seem to have got along very well without them through most of our period. So, you know, the idea of a democratic patronage of art, which has normally been an aristocratic preserve, is a rather new and insecurely founded one.
You write, we should choose the images we want to live with, and we should have some freedom to do so. But who's the we? I mean, we each have freedom to decide what TV we're going to turn on, what art we're going to buy and bring into our home, what records we're going to listen to. We're free to turn on or off any radio or television station. So what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know that that freedom is as preserved as you seem to assume. We are under constant bombardment by commercial messages. You know, they've counted these things. How many people are soliciting us in commercial ways and affecting the very atmosphere we live in? So in a culture that is crackling with all kinds of signals that we really don't bid in one by one, we can't do it, to say that it's all a matter of individual going out and turning off particular things that you don't want to hear is a little unreal, it seems to me.
Well, but applying this, though, to rap music or to, you know, Robert Mapplethorpe shows.
Well, you know, with rap music, labeling, as Tipper Gore suggested, seems to me nothing wrong with that. In fact, when Two Live Crew was hailed before the courts in Florida, which I disapproved of as censorship, one of their defenses was that, after all, we labeled this album. Why are you coming after us? And I think that was a good defense. In the case of Mapplethorpe, again, that was censorship, and I disapproved of it. In fact, I disapproved even of the Cincinnati Museum refusing to admit under 21 into the whole exhibit, warning people before they went into the particular exhibit of films that were considered offensive was one thing. But keeping the children out, keeping minors out of the whole exhibit, I don't see how you could justify that.
Putting some of today's moral censure in a political context, do you think a lot of the moral censure becomes an excuse or an umbrella for also cracking down on diversity, on homosexuality, on certain kinds of feminist thought, on certain kinds of teenage inner-city black slang?
Sure, I think that's true. I think that there is an abuse of censure. When I say I'm for censure, that doesn't mean I'm for all kinds. There's an abuse of almost every kind of moral leadership or moral guidance or moral effort. There's an abuse, for instance, of civil rights disobedience, even though it was a very valuable tool during the civil rights period of the 1960s. So saying that you're for a particular moral tool or weapon doesn't mean you're for every use of it. Dr. King didn't approve of every use of civil disobedience by putative followers of his.
Let's get back to the church. The American bishops just met and didn't budge on the church's policy on birth control. And although one of the bishops urged that the church reconsider its policy and urged that the church consider all the opposition to the policy on the part of the laity.
Mm-hmm.
You've said that you think the church's stand on birth control and abortion is obsolete.
And not only that, but on marriage for priests, on women as priests. In fact, the whole constellation of gender sex issues is one that has been distorted by Catholic authorities for a long time. And the idea that celibate men holding a monopoly over all positions of authority and esteem within a church can make meaningful decisions on these matters seems to me ridiculous.
As a Catholic yourself, do you feel bad when you depart from the church's official stand on things?
Well, the official stand is one thing. The church is not the church's leaders. The body of the faithful has the guidance of the Spirit, according to Catholic theology. And I would feel worse disagreeing with the consensus of the faithful on contraception, for instance, than I do disagreeing with a pope.
How do you describe yourself politically now? You went through a period of being considered a conservative, writing for National Review. This was in the early part of your career. Then you kind of left that crowd. yet you don't call yourself a liberal. You don't think of yourself as a liberal. Do you have a name for where you stand politically? Is there a category that you're comfortable with?
No, I don't think categories are very comfortable things if you're trying to think independently. I suppose radical conservative is one that might... Henry Adams used to call himself that. Several other people have. John Ruskin has been called that. It's not a bad term.
Which part is the radical and which part is the conservative?
Radical is questioning authority, and conservative is honoring tradition. They're two different things, by the way, tradition and authority.
Would you elaborate on that?
Well, for instance, the authorities in the church are the popes and the bishops. The tradition of the church is the moral line of thought that stretches back to gospel times and was often at odds with the idea of papal authority or bishop's authority or anything of that sort. There were no priests in the Pauline community.
Do you ever surprise yourself on the stands that you take on issues?
I don't know that I surprise myself. Sometimes I don't know what I'll think about something until I've grappled with it for a while. I think it's a mistake to come to things sure that you know where you're going to come out before you've listened to a lot of different voices.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Gary Wills, and he's the author of many books about politics and presidents. His new book is called Under God, Religion and American Politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.